Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Another 2 weeks and a little bit left in the winter retreat. So particularly for the resident community to be attentive to the time that we have left, especially as we're moving to the end of a 3 month retreat, it can feel like almost over. You know, the reality is most people in the world will oftentimes plan their lives, or if they're meditators and practitioners, will plan their lives around being able to do a 10-day retreat once a year, so that. You know, we're incredibly fortunate and blessed, and we've got a lot of time left to make use of this opportunity and to build on the momentum that we've gathered through this time. And even though I'm sure with 3 months of retreat time, I'm quite sure that it's not been just onward and upward for everybody. it's the reality is always the waves of sometimes it goes smoothly, sometimes it goes not so smooth, sometimes it's peaceful and clear, sometimes it's just turbulent and turgid. But that's kind of the reality of the human mind, and learning how to be present with that, how to learn from it, recognizing that, that's why they call it practice, and it's Dhamma practice. We're to be taking that opportunity to practice and train with what we're experiencing, and then also recognizing that how we learn is through doing it over and over and over, and learning from our experience, gaining skill in learning how to, it's like the idiom that I can remember Ajahn Chah using, sort of reading our minds, learning how to read our minds, learning how to read the different, whether it's obstacles and difficulties or whether it's smoothness and peace, learning how to read it, because it's in that practicing that we start to gain that skill, gain that understanding of the different ways that the mind presents itself to us. Having a nice theory and a good idea about what we would like to do, it doesn't carry you very far. Sometimes these little factoids are really helpful. In professional baseball, when a pitcher pitches a ball to the batter, the human mind actually can't follow that ball. It's too fast. I can't remember the actual milliseconds, but the actual distance that it is and the speed that that ball comes, a batter can't actually follow that ball. It's released and it's there. But obviously they're able to hit it, otherwise it wouldn't be much of a sport. Not much of a spectator sport. You can't sell season tickets on that. But the professional players, it's through their practice and training and experience that they actually learn how a, let's say, you know, pictures, that they get a feel for where it's going to come by paying attention to the body language of the picture and the turn or the, you know, how whatever. Reading those signals, that they get a feel for where it's going to come so they can hit the ball. It's through practice. It's just through practice, through training, through experimenting, and getting a feel for it. Because it's really interesting, because they had this woman's fastball pitcher pitch to these professional major league baseball players. And sort of like, you know, on a logical basis, you think, yeah, I mean, okay, it's, you know, it's ball must be almost twice as big. It's pitched underhand. I mean, how fast can it get? You can't get it so fast, but it's pretty fast. Because, you know, it's a bit slower than a fastball. But professional baseball players couldn't hit the ball. They couldn't hit a softball. They couldn't even get foul balls. couldn't get it close. I think it's happened so many times, and then it got somebody like Alex Rodriguez, because he wouldn't even do it. Somebody like, forget it. I mean, so, because it's they weren't familiar with the. Obviously, if you're playing softball, then you're hitting the ball as well. But it's like you've learned to read the signals. So it's through practice. That's learning how to read the mind, learning how to read the moods. Because, you know, the moods of the mind, the thoughts, you know, it's actually, you know, it's fast. We have to develop the mindfulness and alertness, and that's why also we put, especially in the Thai forest tradition, but remember the Buddha, the scriptures, the Buddha himself puts a lot of emphasis on mindfulness of the body, because it's learning how to slow down the processes, learning how to get an anchor so that you can get a feel for what the moods are doing, what the mind is doing, learning how to read the mind. So that, you know, mindfulness of breathing is just so nuanced, really. Paying attention to, you know, right from the very beginning, just really paying attention to the physical posture, having that anchor in the posture, learning how to get a feel for the body, learning how to relax the body, paying attention to the you think of the just the image of the Buddha as an archetype or as an example, that, you know, it's real, the way the Buddha is sitting is really, there's a presence and an alertness there. Most Buddha images, the eyes will be slightly open, you know, so that it's not, the Buddha isn't, you know, off in space somewhere drifting. He's right there. And of course, our image isn't that, but there's another image, a very popular one, of the touching the earth image, where the Buddha is sitting with one hand in his lap and the other hand just coming down at his knee, and touching the earth, that sort of, making that connection with everything around. So that's a It's an important beginning of our meditation and of our whole training, our whole practice. Getting anchored in the body, and especially as we're getting to the end of the retreat, take the time to review what are the assumptions I'm making about the body, the mind, am I actually present? Am I relaxed? How does it feel? Do I feel grounded? Do I feel awake and alert? Because those are certainly the kind of buzzwords that are part of the, we speak about the practice, the training, the meditation. Literally the word Buddha meaning the one who knows, a sense of knowing, alertness, the one who's awake, there's a sense of awake, being there with what the experience is, one who's bright, so a brightness that is a part of the that image of Buddha. So getting grounded in that physical experience, the posture, keeping an upright, alert, balanced. It's a nice, thinking of a Buddha image, a quality of balance and a sense of real presence. That was like we're in the process of a Buddha image being carved for our new hall out there, and it's being carved in stone, so it's pretty unforgiving if you don't get it quite right, and that's what it was carved in. And the shoulders were, the monk who's been keeping an eye on, the shoulders weren't, they were kind of slumpy. and he said, no, I don't want that image going to the west. It's sort of the Buddha sitting there with his shoulders kind of slumped. No, it doesn't work. So we have to start over from scratch. I'd rather have a really nice example of a presence of the Buddha. So that sense of posture, and then just bringing that attention into the onto the rhythm of the breath, tuning in to that rhythmic process of our breathing, and just allowing the breath to kind of guide us, not to be trying to control it or trying to force it in any way, but allow the breath to settle into its own rhythm. And we have to kind of trust it to lead us along, because it will. You tune into that rhythm, and there's that attention and awareness and alertness to the rhythm of the breath, trying to be with that rhythm, trying not jumping ahead, trying to force it, not sort of getting left behind and drifting off, but just being really trying to be present with that rhythm, letting it soften and bringing a sense of a kind of ease coming out through the body and through the mind as we attend to that simple rhythmic process. We can still be, as there's quite naturally, the breath has, you know, has different qualities, in the sense that yeah, as we breathe in, there's a natural quality of kind of, you know, certain enlivening or kind of energizing, kind of brightening quality that it has to it. It's coming into being. And then as the out-breath has a natural tendency to have a settling and a soothing or a diffusing quality through the body and then out around us. So that is always attending to that natural rhythm and the, you know, the kind of natural implications that the breath has, or, and both on a physical and mental, emotional level, because it's rather than trying to be on top of it too much in terms of trying to make it be a certain way, and tuning into that sense of, well, actually tuning in, experiencing, being with the breath, and then that sense of experiencing, rather than watching, because we'll use these idioms in the language, and you will say with meditation, okay, just watch the breath as it comes in and goes out. And you know, it has a certain validity, but it also has a certain effect, in the sense that as soon as we start watching something, we'll tend to set up a distance, in the sense of there's the breath outside and there's the watcher inside. There's me and there's something else. There's self and other. And to be finding these very simple ways of connecting with our experience, connecting with the nature of the mind, the nature of our experience, to that sense of tuning in, being with, present for, experiencing the breath as it comes in, as it goes out. And it has this a different effect. It has a way of being with that sense of these qualities of relaxing and alertness, you know, they go together. So it's both, both physically and as well as mentally, where there's a relaxing, a settling. But then there needs to be, in our practice, there needs to be both. And it's both of, in terms of meditation practice as well as our how we go about our daily life. It's a sense of tuning into the body, tuning into the mind, allowing that sense of relaxing and alertness to work together, so that there's a balance happening. As we practice, as we train, as we work with these teachings, and as we, in our meditation, different themes, of course, you pick up for reflection, investigation, in the meditation. It's like, okay, how do I work with overcoming the hindrances? How do I develop, say, factors of awakening? Those are standard sort of practices, and sort of how do I relinquish the unwholesome? How do I develop the wholesome? Relinquish the skillful, develop the skillful. Hindrances are. The Buddha is those qualities that. Obstruct awareness and hinder discernment, hinder wisdom. That's a standard definition, more or less, of what a hindrance is. But this, whether it's sense desire or aversion or drowsiness, restlessness, doubt, those manifest in different ways. But to be paying attention, looking, investigating. Okay, how's that? How do these manifest? How is it? And it isn't a personal thing. It's just the mind. Human minds have hindrances, and they have habits that create obstacles for us. That learning how they manifest, learning and understanding how we can skillfully work with them, learning what they're teaching us. What is it? Because oftentimes the hindrances are the things that inevitably end up in suffering, but it isn't as if we set out to increase our suffering. I mean, it's not that at any given moment, in any part of our living existence, we don't ever really set up an intention, how can I suffer more? There's these habits, and we keep we have to understand them. You can't just sort of disregard that, but it isn't also you can't take it personally. it's not an indication of your ultimate value of being a human being. It's just a hindrance. Being able to recognize, see them, understand them, learn from them, and develop skill around them. And similarly with developing the qualities of factors of awakening. How do we give ourselves skill in developing those qualities that are really supportive and for well-being, for clarity, and similarly, you don't want to create a personality around it. You create, because there's an obstacle that when we take these as. Because take it as me, and especially even if it's something really skillful and good, it's always going to be impermanent. So when your good qualities change, then there's this incredible sense of loss or frustration or embarrassment. But this is why the Buddha used these Four Noble Truths and used that standard of dukkha, of say, unsatisfactoriness of suffering as a basis of investigation, because it's not a personal thing. All we're trying to do is free the heart from its propensity for finding discontent and dissatisfaction. Just learning how to settle. That's where. But these qualities there are certain qualities that are helpful for them. Sort of those, and that's where sometimes say, okay, like mindfulness. Okay, yeah, I should be mindful. I don't know. how do we hold that? We can make that into a really heavy thing. I should be mindful. Not only should, I have to be. even just the language that we use, pay attention to what we're telling ourselves, how we're framing it, how we're holding it. Even like with mindfulness, just the word sati, just that sense of how do we create a sense of presence of mind, or a sense of being with and attentive to our experience. That's the quality of mindfulness. We'll be alert to what we're experiencing. One of the ways that Ajahn Chah used to express it in the Thai language of just sort of being, sort of like being with and being like being on time for our moods, rather than being with it, being present with it. Think of investigation of dhammas, just learning how to investigation, exploring, examining, scrutinizing. There's all sorts of different ways to express it. But that's what we're doing. We're exploring, examining our experience, taking an interest in it. As we do that, and we learn, if we're trying to fit things into, all the right categories, then it gets burdensome. But that sense of just being present with, exploring, bringing a certain energy to things, not so much energy, because that's just like bringing a vitality to the process of practicing and training, and being. Because on a certain level, all we're doing is just watching one in-breath and one out-breath. And I think, how boring can that be? But as it's picked up with that kind of presence and freshness and exploring and a vitality, then it starts to become really interesting. And we start to learn from our experience, and it has an effect. I mean, the mind brightens, becomes buoyant, and it's quite natural. It's with that sense, saying those factors of awakening, piti, you think of joy or rapture. Usually it's translated as joy or rapture, and you think, well, how much rapture have I had today? And it looks You know, what does my rapture look like? But you know, with language, we tend to make assumptions. But then you sort of think of it in terms of, yeah, like a buoyancy of mind, a kind of freshness. Then you say, oh, you're right, that's not so far away, that's not so different. And it's actually quite natural, because when we're really taking, whether it's mindfulness of breathing or doing a chore that we really take an interest in, or a task that we take an interest in, there's kind of a buoyancy and a lightness, a freshness that comes to the mind. It's quite natural. So that the Buddha is giving us encouragement and the tools to be developing and training, practicing with this our experience, and as we learn, it's just mindfulness of breathing, meditation, applying mindfulness and investigation in our daily life, our walking meditation. There's a continuity of awareness that starts to develop quite naturally. Learning how to appreciate it, protect it, care for it is really important. And then to pay attention, and also just even when we think of investigating, reflecting, it isn't as if it has to be some abstruse philosophical concept that we're dealing with. These are natural truths. What the Buddha is pointing to is the things around us, and this is where the Ajahn Chah and the great forest masters just bring it down to real practicality and a certain ordinariness. It's like, think of there's one of Ajahn Mun's senior disciples, Lumpu Kao, and his enlightenment experience was about as ordinary as you could get for a Thai person, in the sense of reflecting on the nature of rice. I mean, and just because he just started reflecting on the cycles of nature, the cycles of the growth of the of rice, because he was in retreat, and up in the north of Thailand, there'd be sort of forest around, and there'd be paddy fields here and there where there was enough flat land. And he's able to, he's watching the rice sort of growing through the rainy season, through its season. And it starts off, and just these little seeds, the villagers throw them out, and it goes through a cycle and sprouts, and then and it keeps going through these cycles of growth and coming to fruition, and part of a cycle that they're, of course, the villagers are attuning to and nurturing, and it comes to the fruition of harvest. It gets harvest again, and then this cycle starts again, and those cycles are however, you know, those same kinds of cycles are repeating themselves in so many different ways. And, you know, in the same way that our practice, you just think of, okay, the cycle of the breath coming in, the breath going out, tuning to that, the cycles of how we apply ourselves through the day, you know, those are nurturing those cycles and learning how to reap the harvest of peace and clarity. And certainly for Limpo Khao, then that was actually the trigger for his full awakening, his enlightenment. And that also is part of it was when he was, it was just a, you know, he was living up in the north in a little shelter, really, a grass roof shelter, quite temporary shelter, enough to keep the rain off, enough walls and roof to keep the rain out and keep them dry for the rainy season. But it was, you know, very basic. And his said when he was leaving, he was just overwhelmed with tears of gratitude to this shelter that had protected him through the rainy season and been given to him, and how he'd been looked after in order to practice. And these are very ordinary things, but they're easy to skip over looking for meaning and knowledge and distraction in other things. That our practice is learning how to pay attention to these ordinary things. And it's like the Buddha himself saying, yeah, in this fathom-long body with its consciousness, that's the place of our awakening. That's where this Dhamma is valid. You know, the Buddha didn't really give his teaching to receive the teaching from the Buddha, then go off to some heavenly realm somewhere to try to figure it out. It's in this body, in this mind, in this present moment, learning how to attune to it, learning how to be with it, because that's the we're always looking for something extraordinary. The ordinary is just too seemingly mundane, you know, and even, you know, to their sense of ourselves. How could I be awakened, enlightened, understand these teachings? I'm just ordinary. I need to be extraordinary. And, you know, we keep looking and moving, and it's just like the ordinariness of, you know, rice growing. It's a lovely story in the scriptures of the Tarigata. Of Pachachara, one of the enlightened nuns in the Buddha's time, and the seed for her awakening was, she was meditating, practicing, and obviously it wasn't a one-off thing. There was a continuity there. After she'd been outside doing walking meditation, and then coming into her dwelling place, as is the case in those days, they didn't really wear shoes very much. So outside dwelling places, you'd always have a water vessel with a dipper, and then you'd wash your feet before going into the dwelling places, or into, say, the meditation hall, or whatever buildings are where you'd be as you're coming in, then you wash your feet. And it was her paying attention to the, like, pouring the water on her feet to wash her feet, which, you know, she'd probably done a gazillion times. But then just paying attention to the water flowing out onto the ground after that. And then it's going, so of course, it starts flowing away, but then it starts, you know, sinking into the ground and being absorbed by the earth. And just that cycle, or that impermanence, that change. So, and it's like everything. Everything is like that. It arises and it ceases. That was the trigger. And then she came into her dwelling place, sat for meditation, and then sort of plucked out the flame of the candle or the lantern to turn it out, and that sort of sealed the deal. That's her awakening. And in her life, how many times did she come in, wash her feet, turn out the light? You know? But it's practicing with mindfulness, with attention, each day. And it isn't as if, you know, well, which one is it going to be? I don't know who's going to be. But it's just being willing to practice, being willing to put the attention, put the time into the breath coming in, going out, the walking meditation, the, you know, cleaning up after the meal. All of these things, everything is an opportunity for awakening, and to pay attention to it, to be with it. But that sense of, you know, getting that balance of relaxation and alertness, being attentive, being alert, you know, having the relaxation and settling there as well. So, you know, that sense of balance is so important. Because it's that quality of knowing that is that one. Because, you know, when we're tense and trying too much, and that quality of knowing becomes kind of on edge and forced. And the same when there's if we're relaxing too much, not sort of sharp and present, so there's this balance is so important, but it's for that quality of knowing, and of course the Ajahn Chah, they put so much emphasis on this, saying, yeah, being the one who knows, that's the foundation of practice, being the one who knows, this sense of, this quality of knowing. And it's not sort of an intellectual analysis of things, just being ready to know things clearly. It's that quality of knowing that can, say desire arises in the mind, and rather than being shocked, disturbed, dismayed, or attracted, excited. It's just known. It can be known. And same with aversion. Doubt. You know, doubt can be known. It's just one of the problems with doubt is, you know, we're always trying to find an answer to our doubts. We don't actually know doubt. We want to have an answer to it. And that's well, good luck. Because that's the nature of doubt, of course, is going to doubt whatever you come up with. And so that to learning how to trust that knowing and being, you know, and that's where, you know, and that's really where the middle way of the Buddhas is. Of course, the middle way is both a way of practice, but it's also a fundamental truth. And it's in that quality of knowing that middle way is expressed. So that is the nature of the mind. Is going to be it's caught in looking for, reacting to, you know, happiness or unhappiness, joy and sorrow. You know, these the swings of the mind, and it's not that they're not there. Again, these can all be known. It doesn't matter how happy one is, it can be known, or how the unhappiness that manifests, it can be known, and we can be with it. We can see it more in its quality of its arising and its ceasing, as opposed to all of the details around it and the story behind it. It's seeing it as this is something arising, it's coming to be. It has a certain quality, a draw, a pull, a story, but knowing it, letting it cease. It's like Ajahn Chah using happiness, unhappiness, joy, sorrow. It's like the head and the tail of a snake. You think one is better than the other. But you grab the tail and it whips around and bites you also. So, and you think, well, and that's that, you know, so learning how to, just let the snake be. Knowing the snake for what it is, knowing phenomena for what they are, knowing the mind, knowing the body, just for what it is. It's like this. And it's not, we don't have to have a, we want to have a judgment or an idea about it, but it's just like this. And we can, that's how we come to a place of peace. I think in terms of, you know, the essence of the Buddhist teachings, or the essence of, you know, Buddhism, is this quality of peace. We can be with however the world or our body minds are manifesting, and we can be at peace with it. It's through that quality of knowing. But it takes practice for reflection.